pleased that you're here. I think both Graham and I are very, very happy to be part of the Boston Book Festival this year. You may notice that we're missing someone here, and that's our very close friend and colleague, Megan O'Sullivan. Unfortunately, at the last moment, she couldn't be with us. But we are here to talk about her book, as well as Graham's book. Megan's book, which has just been published, is entitled Windfall: How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. Megan has been a professor with us at the Kennedy School since 2009. She's an expert on energy, she's an expert on the Middle East, and she's written about the fact that we've moved from scarcity in energy resources over the last 10 or 15 years to abundance. And that's been particularly important for the United States and for Canada and Mexico. Together, we are now the leading producer of fossil fuel energy in the world. That in turn has given us, I think if you'd measure this, say, between 2001 and now, that's given us an unexpected augmentation of our global power relative to some of the others. And it's important, I think, if you read Megan's book, North America has done this, the three countries together. So I hope, we both hope that you will consider her book, because she couldn't be here today. And Graham, before I talk to you about yours, you might want to say a word about Megan as well.
Absolutely. So thank you. It's a great honor to be part of the Boston Book Festival and to be here with one of America's great diplomats, Nick Burns. And I agree entirely with what he said about Megan's book, which I've read with to my education and with enthusiasm. So basically, what she tries to do in the book, and I think it was very ambitious, and she succeeds, is helping us see energy through two lenses simultaneously. So on the one hand, she tells us about the economics of energy and how that's being transformed by the changes in energy supply and demand. And all this goes from fracking to gas to tight oil to renewables on the one hand. On the other hand, the geopolitics of energy, so the ways in which both producing nations, like the U.S., which turns out now to be, at this point, the largest producer of energy. So we now produce more energy, all sources, than does Saudi Arabia or Russia, which used to be. Yeah. So through the geopolitics and the consumption of energy, we also are the number one consumer of energy, mostly now, fortunately, consuming more American energy, how that's changing geopolitics. So I think it's a very interesting book in that regard, and very relevant to what we see happening in the stress of the petrostates. Like if you go to Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan or Mexico or Venezuela or Russia, the fact that the economics are shifting is having a big impact on their political position. And similarly, the U.S. role as a big energy producer now is a big new asset. So I'm a big fan of the book. It's yeah. Just, I'm sorry she's not here. She would give an even more lively presentation about it, but she wouldn't be more enthusiastic about it than I am. Yeah.
But she would definitely be more articulate than both of us in talking about it. Absolutely. I would just add, so it's a really fine book. And obviously we're highly subjective because she's a personal friend of ours and we teach with her. But the other point that is interesting about what Megan sees in the transition in the global energy picture is that the United States is now, for the first time, really, since the 1950s and 60s, independent of Middle East energy sources. Not entirely, we still do import some, but strategically independent. That does liberate us. It allows us to do things like, and by we, it's really the American private sector, because the American government is not moving oil and gas around the world, it's the private sector. But the private sector is now beginning to export liquefied natural gas into Europe. And that, of course, is an attempt to try to break into the Russian stranglehold on the energy markets in Europe. And the private companies in the United States have just begun to export liquefied natural gas to India. And that's part of the strategic relationship that's developing between India and the United States. And we're going to get to that with Graham Allison. So let me just cite the book we're talking about today. Graham has just published a book this past year called Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? Let me say a word about Graham first, and then ask Graham to talk about the book, and then we're going to give you a chance to ask your own questions, and we have microphones here for you to do that, and we'll break well before the end of this session to take your questions. Graham probably doesn't need introduction in Boston, because Graham has been both as a student at Harvard in the early 1960s, as an undergraduate and then a graduate student, and then as a young professor made his mark at an early age. We are commemorating this week the 55th anniversary of the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Graham, I can say this, he won't. Graham wrote the seminal book on the Cuban Missile Crisis called Essence of Decision. I do kid Graham that I read that book in college. The book was published in the early 1970s. It is widely considered to be the most authoritative book on the event. It had the most particular insights. And in addition to that, I think it's one of the great and most important political science books of the last half century. And so Graham might want to mention or say a word about that. He's done so much in his long career. He's the founding dean of the Kennedy School, was dean for the first 12 years. Until very recently, we now have a building boom going on, had built all the buildings at the Kennedy School, and has made a great mark as dean and as director of the Belfer Center, which is the largest center at the school. After, at the beginning of his academic career with his work on the Cuban Missile Crisis, Graham spent a couple of decades ringing the village bell about the problem of nuclear terrorism, the problem of loose nukes, the destabilizing nature of the fact that terrorist groups or evil regimes might get their hands on nuclear or biological or chemical weaponry. He built a big center at Harvard that has, I think, the world's, if I can say this, greatest collection of academic knowledge on nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons in the world, bar none. And he made a great and positive impact on the international debate. And now, in the last several years, Graham has turned his attention to the U.S.-China relationship, and that's the subject of this book. And just to set you up, Graham, for this, I think most of us who are students of international politics agree that for the next half century, going forward, I'm looking at the younger people in the room today, for their generation, this relationship will be the most important for the world and the most important for both countries. On a positive sense, given the fact we're going to be the two largest global economies, the two most powerful militaries, the two most, if you will, dominant societies in the world, we can do great things together. We have a self-interest, Graham, in stabilizing the global economy. President Obama and President Xi Jinping felt they had a common interest on climate change, and they produced the joint venture that led to the Paris 2015 agreement on climate change. Now President Trump, I think very unwisely, has walked away from that. But we tend to think on this side of the divide that somehow China is just a threat. Well, China is a partner to the United States in many ways, but China is also a competitor to the United States in terms of strategic military power. And Graham writes about this interplay and the history of both countries. And the big, profound question, Graham, is how can we avoid war? Because we must avoid war between the United States and China in the 21st and 22nd centuries. Your book talks about this, so I want to welcome you and ask you to answer that first question. Why did you write it? And do you agree with me that we're really dealing with a duality of partnership and competition, and the key is maintaining that balance?
So thank you very much, and again, thank you for being here. And yes, I think you, as usual, capture the dilemma of a duality in which, on the one hand, there are huge shared interests between the U.S. and China, which cannot be accomplished in the absence of a cooperative relationship. That has to do, first of all, with not having a nuclear war. If we actually ended up in a nuclear war between the U.S. and China...
Disaster.
Not just a disaster. At the end of it, the U.S. could have been erased from the map as a functioning society. So that's insane. Yeah. And that bedrock, which was a bedrock in the U.S.-Soviet competition that helped contributed to keeping the Cold War cold, not 100%, because the risks, as you say, in the Cuban Missile Crisis were huge, but that's a bedrock. Secondly, our economies are deeply entangled to the point that we're their biggest consumer and they're our biggest producer. And if we should end up in a conflict with China, Walmarts would be empty and Chinese factories would be producing for what? Who? And where would we get a loan for our deficit? So this is a very thick inner economic entanglement. And thirdly, as you say, climate, where that's not a unanimous view in the country at this point, but I think
it's pretty well established.
All sensible people who've looked at the subject are clear that if we simply continue emitting greenhouse gases the way we've been doing, in 100 years, this is not going to be a climate where anybody wants to live in.
Right.
And ditto, if China just keeps emitting, the same thing, because all the greenhouse gases are emitted into one sphere. So we are harmed by Chinese emissions, they're harmed by our emissions. If we don't work together, this problem is not going to work out. So that's on the one hand. There's a lot of shared interest. On the other hand, and this is principally the focus of the book, when a rising power like China threatens to displace a ruling power, this creates a deep structural stress, a very dangerous dynamic in which both are vulnerable to the action of third parties, which can serve as triggers to a set of actions and reactions that drag them both to a place where they don't want to go.
Right.
And that's the concept of Thucydides' trap. Thucydides had this idea.
Remind us, we're both admirers of Greece. Yes. Remind us about Thucydides.
Okay, let me actually step back and I will just remind you of the book. It does three things. First, it introduces you or reintroduces you, for most of you, to a giant, an intellectual giant, a great thinker, and his name was Thucydides. Since I've been out promoting this book all over the country and internationally for now, ever since Memorial Day, I've discovered many Americans have trouble with this. So, but in Boston, we don't. So we're going to say in unison, 1, 2, 3, Thucydides. You know, one more time.
Thucydides.
So, yes, it's a mouthful, but you now are going to meet and you will in this book, a genuinely great thinker. Thucydides was the founder of history. He wrote the first ever history book. History being understood as the account of what actually happened and the choices of human beings that produced consequences without the help of external spirits or myths or events. So, and he wrote about the classical Greece 2,500 years ago, where as he was focused on the rise of Athens and the impact that had on Sparta. So basically, the reason why he calls his book The History of the Peloponnesian War is because he's developing a whole new discipline, and all of us who study history since then are students, in effect, of Thucydides. Actually, if I do a shout out for Thucydides for one more second, you can go and download for free Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. And I would say as a start, just download the first book, book one. It's about 100 pages. If every other page you don't knock your socks off, check your pulse. This is a book that's full of big and interesting ideas. One of those ideas is called Thucydides' Trap. He didn't call it that. This was his insight. I named it or coined the term Thucydides' Trap to make this vivid for us now. So Thucydides' Trap is a big idea. It's that when a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power, in general, poop happens. So in the book,
they end up in conflict.
In the book, I look at the past 500 years of history. I find 16 cases in which a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power. Think of the rise of Germany and its impact on Britain that 100 years ago allowed the assassination of an archduke to produce a conflagration at the end of which everybody lost. So in 12 of the 16 cases, you end in war. In 4 of the 16 cases, you end without war. So to say that under these conditions, be fatalistic, war is inevitable, would be wrong on the evidence. But to say that under these conditions, there's an extreme danger of war that you wouldn't otherwise understand or expect or anticipate, that's caused by this dangerous dynamic and the normal reactions of a rising power who says, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I deserve more say and sway. The current arrangements were put in place before I even counted. You didn't consult me, you just set the rules of the game and set
as we did following the Second World War.
As we did. And the ruling power, whether it's Britain 100 years ago, as we were rising in our hemisphere, or the U.S. today, says, wait a minute, the conditions that we created and have maintained were the conditions in which you ever grew up to be big and strong. If it weren't for us and for this order, you wouldn't be rising. So you should understand this is in your interest. You should be grateful. You should even help support this structure because it's good for everybody, especially for you. And I would say, as you and I have both spoken many, many times, and it's absolutely true to Chinese or other Asians, what the U.S. did after World War II in Asia is nothing less than amazing. We established basically the Pax Americana in Asia. We created a security and economic order that Asia had never seen before in all of recorded history, conditions in which that enabled Asian miracles all over and nowhere more successfully than China. Yeah. So they should be grateful. But if I go back, I have a great chapter in the book that most Americans I find very uncomfortable, which is what if Xi's China were just like us? Just like us when we were emerging under the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt, that what we were supremely confident was going to be an American situation. And the way we treated the British, who had for 100 years provided this order, which they explained to us had been so good for us that we had been able to grow up to become big and strong, is a pretty salutary reminder that as rising powers rise, they're not usually very grateful. They do try to upset the apple cart. They are insisting about their own interests. So that produces this dynamic in what we see in the current relationship.
Good. And Graham, if we could just continue to frame this big book for this audience. What I hear you saying in the book is that since 1945, since the United States largely created this multilateral system of alliances and interlocking economic institutions and the UN system, we've avoided a great power war, which is an incredible achievement.
Absolutely.
We've fought a lot of regional wars, Korea in the 50s, Vietnam in the 60s and 70s, the Balkan Wars of the 90s, the wars of the Middle East and Afghanistan the last 16 years. But nothing like the 16 million dead from 1914 to 1918, or the 660 million dead between 1937 and 1945 and two world wars. We've avoided it in large part because the United States has been so dominant, but I would say generous.
Absolutely.
In the way it's conducted itself despite mistakes. And now we have a situation, as I understand you, where China is rising very assertively and with great strength and with great will, and there is a possibility of a clash. And we have to find a way to diminish the possibility of a clash. You've got a lot of ideas for how to do that in this book.
But you certainly capture the big idea about the fact 7 decades without great power war is historically anomalous,
yes.
Extremely anomalous. There's a great essay that I refer to in the book by the Yale historian John Gaddis,
yeah,
called The Long Peace, which points out this just doesn't normally happen. So the structures that the U.S. created in the aftermath of World War II, because the folks who did it had seen World War I was just 20 years before, so the system wasn't working. So they really did try to create a new international order.
Yeah.
And it had an economic piece with the IMF and the World Bank and a trading system and an open trading system. It had a security piece with the alliance structure, NATO in Europe, but also the U.S.-Japan treaty and then the treaty with
South Korea.
Yeah. It had a political dimension where it was an encouragement of participatory governments and ultimately democracies. So this is a grand American project. In the case of China, it provided the framework in which China has now grown to be as big and strong as we are in many dimensions.
Yeah.
So certainly a rival and potentially to overshadow us in many arenas. And from the Chinese perspective, as we heard this week in China with the 19th
Party Conference,
where President Xi Jinping was in effect coronated or crowned as almost like a new emperor of China.
He's as powerful today as Mao was
in
his 60s.
And he has very ostensibly and very conspicuously no identified successor. So not only has he got a pathway for 5 more years, but for beyond. So, and he's got a grand set of ambitions. He explained those ambitions very, very explicitly in a 3.5-hour work plan speech, the way they do it. But he says,
can you imagine Donald Trump giving a 3.5-hour speech on anything?
I can't imagine myself listening to a 3.5-hour
speech. Sure. That's for sure.
From anybody. But in any case, these people were listening very carefully. And if you listen, because every page of it, every paragraph, tells about a work plan where they're trying to do things. And their ambition, unquestionably, is in the foreseeable future to displace the U.S. as the predominant power in Asia.
Not globally. So
not globally.
Asia.
In Asia for the foreseeable future. Later is later. But now is now. So the line says in the speech, we're going to stand tall and strong in the East. That's what it says. And everybody else in the East, as Nick knows extremely well, because he knows all these countries, that was like yes, I heard that.
Yeah.
And we understand what that means. So from his perspective, seeing Americans on the Korean Peninsula looks anomalous.
35,000 American troops.
Right. But the question, again, go back to my chapter on if they were just like us. Teddy Roosevelt, when he arrives in Washington, 37 years old to be the number two person in the Navy, he says, what the hell are the Spanish doing in Cuba? Right, 90 miles off our shore. They shouldn't be here. And as soon as we found an occasion when there was a mysterious explosion
1898.
In 1898, we declared war on Spain, defeated them, liberated Cuba, took Puerto Rico, that's how Puerto Rico,
Guam.
And took Guam as a spoil of war. So you look and you say, okay. And similarly, he looks out and he sees Xi Jinping. The U.S. Navy is the arbiter of events in the South China Sea. As I write in the book, the Chinese Navy guy tells me, he said, you know, China sees, China sees. He says, we look out from our border and we say, look at your own map. What name of this body of water right next to us? It's called South China Sea.
East China Sea, the north.
China Sea. You think that's by accident? Yeah. No, that's the lake beside us, like the Caribbean is to you. So why is your Navy the arbiter of that? I tell them the story of the Battle of Midway and how we've been there for 70 years and why that provided the condition under which China grew up to be big and strong. And he says, okay, that was then, but that was now. So, butt out.
Yeah. So there's so much to talk about, but two big questions for you. And let me just say as a preface to those questions, when you read this book, Graham's entire academic, intellectual, and professional life, if I can say this, has been dedicated to preventing war among the great powers, essence of decision, your focus on nuclear terrorism, this book. But Graham also served several times in government, Reagan administration,
for Secretary Weinberger, but also we served together for President Clinton, trying to deal with an emerging Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I want to, based on your experience, professional in the government, intellectual at Harvard, two questions. Do you believe after 5 years of study that produced this book, that the United States and China will find a way to coexist, will compete for power, but we won't end up in a catastrophic nuclear war that could change the world for the worse for centuries? And second, there's a guy named Kim Jong-un. He's 33 years old. He has no prior employment or management experience. The only American that he's ever really talked to is a very good ex-basketball player, but probably not the guy you want to negotiate, Dennis Rodman, the nuclear weapons future of the Korean Peninsula. Can we avoid a war on the Korean Peninsula that would drag in China on the side of North Korea? So two big policy questions that President Trump is obviously having to face on our behalf.
Two great questions, and I don't know the answers. So I would say I'm not fatalistic at all, and the book is not fatalistic. I'm not even pessimistic. I'm congenitally optimistic, and as Nick said, most of what I've tried to do over a career is about preventing unnecessary wars, not getting into wars.
Right.
But I think unless we recognize that, strange as it seems, inconceivable almost as it seems, under the conditions of a rising power threatening to displace a ruling power, just a rising China thinking, well, what are we doing in the South China Sea? Well, the U.S. Navy's not leaving the South China Sea. We think we're there stabilizing and making a secure environment for everybody.
Including us.
Including us, but especially for all the neighbors. We think we're in the East China Sea because if we weren't there, China's problems with Japan would be way worse, as we explained to them. And I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
So I think we're performing a service. It's in our interest because our interest is in a peaceful world, but we're contributing something that's good for them if they understood it the way we did. But I can understand if I try to put on their hat, or looking at it from their perspective, they're thinking, well, okay, but still now we're big enough and strong enough, we can deal with this. So this is going to be extremely dangerous, extremely, I would say, even perilous.
Yeah.
And therefore, unless we understand that this condition, which will continue not for a day or a week, there's no fix for this, this is a condition that we're going to have to deal with for a generation, as you say, unless we recognize it, we won't stretch ourselves to the level of imagination and creativity and adaptability and a willingness to adjust that'll be required. Now, I have a good chapter in the book on the Cold War, and I take some comfort from the fact that we actually did face something like this before with the Soviet Union. It seemed like, oh my goodness, this is going to be unsuccessful. George Kennan, one of the great figures in American diplomacy, wrote back to Washington in April of 1946, just a year after World War II, saying the Soviet Union is going to pose a greater existential threat to the U.S. than the Nazis did. Truman and everybody else said, forget about this. This is crazy. We're exhausted.
They wanted a peace.
We've just had a peace. We're bringing the troops home. We're not talking about this. And over 4 years, people developed this strategy for the Cold War. And this strategy, which you and I worked within, you know, for all of our careers, had the economic and political and military dimensions, which was remarkable, breathtakingly remarkable. But we persisted with it for four decades, and it was successful. So, are Americans capable of dealing rising power versus ruling power imaginatively with a strategy? I would say, for sure, we've done this once, so I don't see why we couldn't, in principle, do this again. But not the Cold War and the development of the constructs of the Cold War and the strategy. You and I have, as students or as professionals working within that framework, you know, just thought, whoa, the reason why we call these folks the wise men because they were really wise. They thought hard. They worked hard. They thought of things that nobody would have ever thought of. Who in the world would have thought a year and a half after World War II, we're exhausted, we've already spent ourselves, that we should take 1.5% of American GDP each year for the next 3 years and send it to Europe to help rebuild Europeans and the Marshall Plan,
yeah.
including Germans who had been killing us. I mean, that was a crazy idea. George Marshall launched this idea at a Harvard commencement in 1947, and we just recognized the 60th anniversary of it last June. Amazing idea. Who would have thought of the idea of NATO? George Washington told us no entangling alliances, especially these Europeans are going to drag you into trouble. But people created NATO. Nick was the ambassador to NATO. NATO says attack on one is an attack on all.
Article 5, exactly
what George Washington told us to watch out for. But that created the security framework that's produced this 7 decades, just as you were talking about. So I would say, is it conceivable that we can be imaginative enough if we take seriously the danger? Yes, since we have done before. Will this generation prove capable of doing that? I'd say the jury is out. And then to the North Korean piece, I agree with you completely that if Thucydides were here, he would say to us, just what I told you about. Under this dangerous dynamic, third-party actors whom you're going to think are not really, you would think they're minor actors, inconsequential. I mean,
a Serb nationalist in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1914.
Killing some archduke whom, again, nobody can remember his name until he got killed. And one thing leads to the other. Here's a little guy in a teeny, isolated, impoverished country, and he's going to drag you two into a war?
Is Kim Jong Un that person that we need to worry about?
I would say absolutely, absolutely.
Is it the greatest danger we face right now?
It's certainly the most urgent, and it seems inconceivable. I mean, when you think of it, you think, it's not possible for a little guy like that, who's that erratic,
small country.
In a little country, that's that inconsequential. China is, 100 times bigger, 1,000 times bigger than North Korea. U.S., 1,000 times bigger. This little guy can't do this. The answer is, well, if this little guy just keeps testing ICBMs, then in the next year, before this time next year, he will either have continued testing ICBMs and he'll have a certified capability to deliver a nuclear warhead against San Francisco. That's either,
and then
or
maybe Chicago, and then maybe
Chicago,
Boston.
And pretty soon Boston, because he's not going to stop at San Francisco if he gets there, if he has that capability. Or there's going to be some radical intervention. And Trump told Xi Jinping at the Mar-a-Lago Lago in April, and he's going to tell him again when he goes to visit there in 2 weeks, if you don't solve this problem now, I'm going to solve the problem. And you're not going to like the way you do it because I'm going to attack North Korea to prevent it being able to attack San Francisco. To which the answer is, Xi Jinping told him in Mar-a-Lago, wait a minute, that's exactly how you would end up with a war on the Korean Peninsula. And if there's a war on the Korean Peninsula, it's going to drag China into the war. And if it drags China into the war, we're going to be in a war with you. And you don't want a war with us, and we don't want a war with you. That would be crazy. So I'd say that's the problem we're going to see play out over the next months.
And just to put it, I'm sure you're going to get a question on North Korea. Right now, most people in the American government, including most especially our generals, do not seem to want to attack preemptively North Korea because they fear the unintended consequences of such an attack.
Right.
A huge conventional war that could kill tens or hundreds of thousands of civilians in the first few days. And that's no exaggeration.
And then in such a war, tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Because
that's what Secretary Mattis has said in his testimony to Congress.
And because even if you started with a conventional attack, the North Koreans do have nuclear weapons, they could use them.
Right.
The Chinese have said publicly, if the United States attacks North Korea, China will intervene militarily on behalf of North Korea. They've also said
if North Korea attacks Japan or South Korea or American forces on Guam unilaterally, China will stay out of it.
Right.
And so the Chinese are saying to us, as I hear it, think about strategic deterrence. And Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson have been very clear about that. We're not trying to replace the North Korean regime. We're not going to attack. But if you attack us, we will defend ourselves, and we will inflict unacceptable punishment on you. I think that's right. I think we should go back to the strategic deterrence that won the Cold War. The problem with the Tillerson-Mattis statement is they've been openly and directly contradicted by President Trump's tweets of the last 30 to 40 days, which seem to intimate that he might use unilateral force. And if Kim Jong-un believes he might, will Kim Jong-un think make a mistake? And might we end up with a war without trying to have a war?
Absolutely.
By mistake?
Absolutely.
Isn't that the great risk here?
I'd say this one is fraught with risks. Okay, so first, you got exactly right. So as Secretary of Defense Mattis has testified many times on this, and so it's a public thing, he says there is a military option. There are a range of military options. We're not in favor of a military option.
Right.
Because we should recognize that if we attack North Korea, it is very likely there's going to be a catastrophic war. And he says to members of Congress, let me remind you, this is not like what you think of war. You think war is the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, things in which a couple of thousand or 3,000 Americans are killed. No. This would be a catastrophic war like the First Korean War, where 50,000 Americans died and hundreds of thousands of Chinese died and millions of Koreans died. So don't think of this as, quote, the kind of wars you've been thinking of before. Think of this like real, real big war. But he says, if that's the only option and the president says that for us to execute it, we will do that. And at the end of the war, Korea will be unified, the Kim regime will be gone, and we will win. That's what he testified. And he did not answer the question, and no member of Congress asked him the question, what about China? And I have said to him, his testimony is exactly what MacArthur would have said in 1950. Again, most people don't remember. I have a little bit of this in the book. In 1950, we already saw this movie. North Korea attacked South Korea, almost captured the whole peninsula. U.S. came to the rescue very last minute, pushed North Koreans back up the peninsula, crossed the 38th parallel, which was the starting point. We're approaching the Chinese border.
The Yalu River.
MacArthur said, we're going to finish this up before Christmas and bring the troops home. Korea be unified, this problem is fixed. Out of the blue, this is 1 year after Mao is consolidating control of mainland China. And China is 100th the size of the U.S. The U.S. is the supremo superman.
China's a poor country in 1950.
Extremely poor. The U.S. has a nuclear monopoly. We've just dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 5 years before. So this guy could never attack us. It's inconceivable. Wakes up one day, 300,000 Chinese, many of them not even having shoes, attack. Another 500,000 come behind them. They push us right back down.
First Marine Division pushed back down the peninsula.
Right back down to the 38th parallel, where the war had started, where we had to sue for an armistice. So I think from a Chinese point of view, they say there's not going to be a unified Korea that's an American military ally. That's not going to happen. That's what we fought a war about.
Yeah.
But if Kim Jong-un keeps testing ICBMs, and Trump then attacks the launch pads to prevent that happening, and North Korea then attacks Seoul, and we then attack the North Korean artillery and rockets that can attack South Korea, we're going to have the Second Korean War.
So that seems to be some kind of ominous...
Start questions.
So
I think the dog has said enough of this. Yes.
We are in danger of depressing everybody in the church today. So I'm just going to We're going to go to questions, but Graham, I just wanted, Graham and I were talking before we came down. We have a very close friend who passed away 2 years ago, Ambassador Steve Bosworth. Steve was a career Foreign Service officer. He was ambassador to South Korea, ambassador to the Philippines. He was President Obama's North Korea negotiator. And he was 11 years dean at Tufts at the Fletcher School. And in the last part of his life came to teach with us. And his office was across the hall from Graham and me. Steve came into my class, I think three and a half years ago, my great powers class of 75 students from 25 countries. And he said, what Graham has written about, the U.S.-China relationship, the great strategic competition for power, he said it's going to be the greatest challenge that the American people have ever faced is to not be dominated by China, but not to get into a catastrophic war. And I stopped him. I said, Ambassador, the American Revolution, the Civil War, the World War II, this is going to be a greater challenge? He said, yes. Now, whether you agree with him or not, he was a serious person. That's a big statement. And I would maintain that what Graham has written about in Destined for War, which I hope you all will read, is the most important question, particularly for younger Americans, as they move forward and take the baton of leadership from our generation. And that is to keep us at peace and yet hold the American position, our free market defense of free markets, of trade, of our allies, of democratic nations in East Asia that don't want to be trampled upon by the Chinese.
Right.
And so we're going to have to be very skillful in balancing partnership and competition with China. That's why I think your book is so important.
I think that there's no greater geostrategic challenge for the U.S. today, or for as far as we can see. So when Steve Bosworth, was one of the great teachers for both of us about this and about what its impact is going to be on the Asian community in the first instance, which he knew extremely well, having been ambassador to the Philippines, ambassador to South Korea,
yeah,
and then the negotiator in North Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, thank you. And thank you, Graham, for writing the book. Thank you for speaking with us. Let's go right to questions. Yes, sir.
Thank you both. My question is about the theory of realism and the idea of national interest. So the theory of realism sort of roughly says that to understand the international system, you have to think about the interests of nations. And it seems like that kind of fits with a lot of what you've both been talking about. It seems like that idea is at risk of being challenged or misunderstood from both left and right. So on the left, maybe a reluctance to think about national interest as a sort of legitimate area for sort of analysis, and on the right, sort of treating national interest as a moral good rather than just a way of understanding the world. So my question to you both is, what is the role of national interest in understanding our international system, and how do we keep that from limiting the scope of our moral ambition?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Professor Allison.
Okay, we could give one of the dangers of professors is this, one of our former colleagues, now deceased, used to say, they speak in 50-minute sound bites. So that's a subject for the whole course, not just a question, but just briefly. So I hold to the proposition that the national interests are the fundamental foundation for trying to understand what nations do in international affairs. They sometimes get confused about their national interests. They sometimes have arguments about it. But basically, if you think about national interests as a hierarchy of interests, sort of like the hierarchy of interest of individuals, the survival and well-being of their country is the fundamental bedrock for their engagement in the world. Now, they may make noises about this and noises about that, but eventually if something comes to threaten their survival and well-being of the homeland, they take that into account.
Right.
That bedrock, therefore, in the U.S.-Chinese relationship is something that if we look at and think about, we think, wait a minute, in order for us to survive, we have to avoid a nuclear war with China. If we get into a nuclear war with China, we don't survive, whatever else we were doing is not going to matter. So that's bedrock. Then we do economies. the entanglement of the U.S. and Chinese economy and the fact that the two biggest economies in the world are benefiting us hugely for our well-being. So if we don't find a way to manage that competition, we will both be impoverished,
yeah,
and maybe even into a conflict. The climate, if we manage to screw up the climate, we won't survive.
We're the two biggest carbon emitters.
We're the two biggest carbon. So basically, that I think that's a healthy part. I think what unfortunately happens from time to time, and that's not the end of the story. There's no reason not to have an idealistic layer that relates to this, because we're trying to accomplish something in the world. But I think that fundamental bedrock, as we go back to it and think of it, will help us recognize how dangerous the U.S.-Chinese relationship is, but how essential it is to cope with it successfully, or otherwise we lose the whole game.
Yeah. And Graham, this is a great question, because, and just take one more minute on this, then we'll go to the next question. Some of your critics have said, in response to this book, wait a minute, Graham, in those prior cases where two great powers, rising and established, clashed, nuclear weapons wasn't part of the landscape, and that nuclear weapons are depressing great power outbreak of war because of the catastrophic consequences of the use of nuclear weapons. And some also say, well, China is competing with us, but they've risen within the American-led system. They're doing really well. They don't want to destroy that system. So wouldn't self-interest, national interest dictate that the Chinese and Americans are going to do everything they can to back away from war?
And I'd say yes and yes, but more complicated. So in the nuclear arena, there's no question that my adversary having the ability to destroy me has a crystal ball effect, as political scientists say, that basically I look and think, well, I can't go there, so I'm more cautious.
Yeah.
But to go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, even under those conditions, John Kennedy was prepared to run a 1 in 3 chance of nuclear war with Russia, the Soviet Union, that would have killed 100 million people.
Conservative estimate.
To prevent the Soviet Union putting nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba. So you look and you think, wait a minute, in retrospect, you would run a chance of nuclear war over nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba when the Soviet Union already had nuclear-tipped missiles in the Soviet Union. It's a breathtaking idea. And actually, another reason for thinking, what risk will Trump run of war, even, God forbid, nuclear war, to prevent North Korea from having nuclear-tipped missiles that can hit San Francisco? I'd say the answer is, it's certainly not zero. It's certainly not zero.
And
does that make any sense? Well, I mean, go back and look and see what Kennedy did. It's just, I think, extremely complicated. I think the economic piece, similarly. Yeah.
And it's a whole other area we probably won't have time to talk about. President Trump's intellect, his understanding of history, his ability to be disciplined, his ability to think of the interests of the other side, as Kennedy did when he proposed the compromise that ended, you know this better than I do.
Yep.
I worry about the commander-in-chief in this instance, this commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, in this kind of situation.
But in every case, a new commander-in-chief who's never been in this world in his first year has a difficult time. So we should remember, even for John Kennedy, in the fourth month in office, he does the Bay of Pigs. He doesn't quite know. So people are learning what they're doing. Our old colleague, the famous professor Dick Neustadt, wrote about what he called transition phenomena, where in the first year, all administrations are perilous. In this case, in particular, where a person became elected president who had no experience with politics, no experience with government, no experience with diplomacy, and not a great reader of history, there's a more dangerous. Yeah.
We're really depressing people. yes, sir.
Gentlemen, thank you for speaking today. In the popular discourse now, we hear a lot about global warming, and you're going on to talk about things like resource competition among nation states and so on as part of the geopolitics theme and so on. But I hear very little in the discussion of these subjects about the trends in world population growth and how these are the causes of global warming. These are the causes of resource consumption. These are the causes of deforestation and overfishing. Can you remark on that, please?
Well, I would just say very briefly, because we want to get as many people in as possible, and thank you for your question. There's no question that as we look out at the world, we're at 7.6 billion people right now. That'll likely rise that figure to about 9 billion by 2050. Demographers then think it might actually diminish a little bit. That there's a connection, particularly in countries that are at stress, Bangladesh, India, two good examples in South Asia, between the size of your population and resource constraints and environmental change. And change of climate is affecting food production, right? It may even instigate wars in a competition for resources. So you're exactly right to point the finger at it. This wasn't the focus of Graham's book, but you're right to say that we've got to focus on this. But I don't regret you answer for yourself.
No, given the time, I would agree. I think it's a very big issue, very important issue. It has an element in the U.S.-Chinese component because, as Nick mentioned before, the U.S. and China are the two biggest greenhouse gas emitters.
Yeah.
So we're the biggest source of the problem. And the emissions are essential for our energy, which are essential for our growth, and especially for China. So China, the biggest burner of coal. China is not about to give up burning coal for a long time. India is the next biggest. Yeah. India is not about to give. So I would say the reason why recognizing the danger over the long run of climate effects and therefore the necessity for the major actors to take the lead in doing something was why actually Obama's deal with Xi on climate, which then led to the Paris Accord, as Nick said, was such an important start, and why our abandoning that field is so dumb.
Please.
Yes, I wanted to go back to the discussion for a minute about North Korea and the problem with North Korea. And I wanted to ask in relation to that, the potential role of Russia, given that Putin is has become so assertive in Ukraine, in Syria, and as was reflected in the recent Frontline presentation, which depicted an almost paranoia on his part about bringing Russia back to the fore and being a rising power. So it's like a little complication for Thucydides here that there are two rising powers adjacent to North Korea. So I'd just like your comment on that.
Let me just start, and I'm going to hand this over to our author to talk about this. I think President Trump, and I will try to say something positive. I'm not a supporter. But I think on China, he's been able to move the Chinese towards tougher sanctions against North Korea than President Obama or President Bush or President Clinton. And I work for two of the three. And I think he's been able to engage Xi Jinping. We'll see if the Chinese do more. President Putin, Graham, I see as almost a spoiler, dyspeptic on this subject. He's helping the North Koreans to some extent. I mean, do you agree with that? That China's been a more responsible player than Russia?
Absolutely, but as you suggested, it's extremely complicated. So first, on China, I think if I try to have some hopeful notes here, I think Xi Jinping, having now gotten his full endorsement, even coronation, as the single dominant leader of China, is going to, I predict, come out of the blocks in the next months with a lot of initiatives at home and abroad. And I'm hoping that one of those will be North Korea, in which he will say to Kim Jong-un, too much is enough. What you've done so far, you're going to have to stop. And if you don't stop, I'm going to squeeze your oil lifeline.
Economically. Yeah.
North Korea will not survive except for the oil that comes through a pipeline from China. And China can squeeze that at will, and if they squeeze it, Kim Jong-un is going to have to respond. Now, they've been hesitant to do that before because the Chinese say, well, this guy is so erratic, we don't know what he will do. Maybe he will attack somebody, could even attack us. So they've been very cautious about that, but I think he's going to, I'm hopeful, if I'm trying to be hopeful, he'll be less cautious. On the Russian piece, I think one of the difficulties is that if we cast Putin's Russia as a spoiler and treat them only as a spoiler, they have no incentives to do any other thing else than be a spoiler. And I think that this is not to say that Putin doesn't wish us ill in most every arena, and that his interests, as he understands them, are in conflict with ours. But I think one of the things that President Obama did very successfully, and Secretary Kerry and the team that negotiated with Iran, was have Russia 100% on side.
Yeah.
In the case of the elimination of the Syrian nuclear weapons, Russia did more work than we did.
Yeah.
As the person who was in charge of it, the Scandinavian lady, said, every hard problem the Russians solved. I mean, the Americans were essential, but the Americans couldn't deal
Russia
with
Russia had the relationship with Assad.
Yeah, Americans couldn't deal with Assad.
Yeah.
So I think that, unfortunately, by not finding some ways not to have to cast Putin as something more than a spoiler, to give him some incentives to be something more than a spoiler, we invite him, in a case like North Korea, to be unhelpful. Because if all you're doing is giving me pain, and all you're doing is being harsh to me, why should I be doing a favor for you?
Right. I think Graham's right to suggest that ultimately, if we can move North Korea to negotiations, avoid war, there's going to be a couple of countries that are going to be key: China, Russia, but particularly South Korea and Japan, as well as the U.S. I think we have time for one more question. Please.
Thank you. Understandably, North Korea takes a lot of the air out of the room in dealing with the U.S.-China relationship. But I know another issue for American businesses is when they operate in China, how safe is their actual holdings, how secure is their intellectual property? And given that, with naval shipping and so on going more and more to the Chinese, and TPT, the TPP deal being set aside, do you know what is taking place or what ought to take place in terms of international institutions so that free trade can exist between those countries instead of just being at the bilateral particular deals of the U.S. versus China?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I'll just say one word, but hand it over to Graham. And Graham, this is your final word. Give us some hope so that we leave here feeling buoyant. I would say that you're exactly right. If you talk to most American companies that have gone into China, the Chinese rip off their intellectual property once you get to China. And we had a way to deal with that: the Trans-Pacific Partnership, President Obama's free trade agreement, 12 countries, 40% of global GDP. China would have been, in a way, I think over time, Graham, forced to adhere to international standards on intellectual property and on trade. President Trump, very unwisely, the great negotiator, in the fourth or fifth day of his administration, pulled us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, got nothing for it, gave a big strategic advantage to China, undercut the American corporate sector, in my view. How about yours?
Okay, so I would say that one of the charming events occurred last January at Davos, where the U.S. being absent, other folks there said to Xi Jinping, well, you're the leader of the global, liberal, rule-based international trade order. And as I know from somebody who works for him who was there, they were just shocked because they know they run the most protectionist, most mercantilist, most exploitive, predatory
anti-democratic
economy. Well, leave the democracy side. Yeah. This is the economic thing. So economically, China has been taking advantage of the system in every way that it has been allowed to, and I think the U.S. has been, under previous administrations, more willing to give them a pass by saying, well, let them get a little wealthier, and they'll have more stakes in the system, and then they'll become more responsible. And then just in the same way that as they get wealthier, they'll become more democratic. And I think little by little now people are waiting. waking up, and I certainly argue in the book about this, and this is books written before Trump, to the proposition that the hopes that we shared, especially after the end of the Cold War, for what Frank Fukuyama had called the end of history, that we were going to see all countries now become like us. They were going to have market economy, so they'd get wealthier, and then that was going to lead to political demands for participation and democracies, and then democracies wouldn't fight each other, so we would have peace. And this became popularized by Tom Friedman in his famous Golden Arch theory, which said two countries that have McDonald's with golden arches can't fight each other. Okay? So I would say we look back on that now and sort of chuckle. And so that was extremely romantic. And I think we're waking up to the fact that, no, China's not about to become a democracy. And actually what was talked about
so Trump
at
is
the
right,
Party Congress
in a way.
Not going to be a democracy. And as to a market economy, well, they're not going to look like us. They're going to have a state-led market economy, as they call it. And they're going to cheat by the rules to whatever extent they can get away with. So I think we're going to have to organize, and I think your point about TPP, I agree with, that we have to organize, that's just not just ourselves, because we're no longer the biggest economy. You know, the biggest, no, read chapter one, and you'll see about this. So the idea that we have to have allies who are other big, strong economies playing by rules that we can all play with,
Japan.
To make like Japan, like South Korea, like India, like Australia, like Europe, okay, that then that creates a correlation of forces to which China has to adapt and adjust.
Right.
So just to end on a positive note, I think if we just think business as usual, the way we've been practicing it, is going to produce good results, we're not taking Thucydides seriously. Business as usual will produce history as usual. And history as usual of this will be a catastrophic outcome we don't want. So that's the bad news. The good news is what Santayana taught us. Only those who refuse to study history are condemned to repeat it.
Right.
So there's no obligation for us to do this. And the purpose of the book is actually to say we should wake up to the fact that we have a condition of extreme danger. We should therefore study history to learn the lessons from it, and then we should be very imaginatively applying that, as in fact we did in the case of the Cold War.
And I hope that all of you will consider reading this thought-provoking, important book by my friend Graham Allison. Thank you for being here, but please join me in thanking Graham.